Join us in a world where you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Sit back as we discuss hard-won lessons from the best and brightest that the personal defense and competition shooting industry has to offer. Let us help you help yourself, no matter where you are in your personal path. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by LuckyGunner.com and Federal Premium Ammunition. They paid for this, so you don't have to. Now here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by LuckyGunner.com and Federal Premium Ammunition. They paid for this, so you don't have to. It's awful nice of them. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at BallisticRadio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, photos, videos, other things, whatever moves me, at Facebook.com/BallisticRadio. Hey, Joe.
You sound very perky today.
It's a lie. No, man, I'm excited to be here. The travel schedule has been such that we haven't recorded new episodes for a while. And for some reason, some jerk decided that we're going to do 6 or 7 right now. The jerk being me.
But I'm ready.
I'm ready. But hey, guess what?
What is that, John?
This segment also brought to you by Lucky Gunner and Federal Premium Ammunition. Whether there was a firefight or you do, in fact, want to worry about that little guy, you need more ammo. And when it's time to restock, you can't beat Federal Premium Ammunition at LuckyGunner.com. With a shipping department that's always moving at 88 miles per hour, if I order a case of American Eagle from Lucky Gunner on a Thursday, it's at my doorstep, ready to shoot before the weekend starts. Head to LuckyGunner.com today to check out their in-stock lineup of Federal Premium Ammunition. And remember, unless you're on fire or drowning, or perhaps have a weak subflooring system that will not support the weight, you can never have too much ammo. Hey, joining us, it's Daryl Bulkey. Hey, Daryl, what's up?
How you guys doing today?
Oh, I can't complain, man. I'm actually super, super glad to be here. But how are you doing?
Good. Yeah, sitting in a hotel room on a travel trip. Well, talking to you about one of my favorite subjects, so it'll be fun.
Well, it will be fun. So what we're going to talk about today is the rotary assault cannon, the revolver, and some of the history and other things. And this is actually prompted from a little drive-by post that I saw in a Facebook group that you commented on. They were talking about the Fitz special, which, for those that don't know, was a modification that was done in the early half of the 20th century to revolvers and some semi-autos, but front of the trigger guard was removed and some other things that were done. And people were commenting on just how, you know, it doesn't serve any purpose. And
I squared them away on that.
Well, you kind of did. I didn't see your response, but you said that, you know, if you understood the historical things, I want to say that it was somewhere along the lines of, you know, something that we don't necessarily do today, but it's not that it didn't make sense with the protocols that they had back then in the historical context. So what I'm curious about is, I guess, my first question, and we'll talk about the Fitz special. Tell me about the history of that, what it is, who came up with it, and sort of we'll go from there. But I feel like there's a lot of things that get missed when we look at stuff that used to be done just because we don't understand everything surrounding it.
Okay, so you want me to start on the Fitz?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so John Henry Fitzgerald was a rep for Colt. And not sort of in the traditional sense, but a lot of almost what today we would call a sponsored shooter, an influencer, you know, in the days before computers, where an industry influencer would actually go out and talk to people and, you know, regularly travel and represent the company. But what a lot of people don't know is he was also a New York state police officer. And what what Fitz did that gets missed with a lot of people is, if you think about the era, and it was a very interesting era in, you know, say the 19, going full, starting into the teens to the 1920s, is we were getting out of horseback carry and into vehicle carry. We were also getting out of rural area firearms carry into metropolitan area firearms carry. And in big metropolitan areas, I mean, we had some cities before that, but, you know, they called it the Roaring Twenties for a reason. And you were starting to see skyscrapers and paved streets for vehicles. And it was a kind of a real change in that era from a lot of the traditional things we do. Well, what Fitz would do with his revolver, so he was kind of the originator of the combative snub, so to speak. The reason there is a Colt Detective Special was Fitz. But he would take, he started out, what he would take is new service revolvers, which were big, giant, the equivalent of a Smith in frame. They were a very full size, large revolver, and usually chambered in, you know, things like 45 Colt. The ones that went over to England were in 455 Ely, you know, 44 Special, that type of thing. And he would cut the barrels down to a couple inches, remove the front half of the trigger guard in front of the trigger, remove the hammer, and then have the, or the back half of the hammer, the spur, and then have the top of the hammer checkered. And the reason for this was, you know, the Colts were very much set up to be cocked into single action. And the theory of the day for a lot of that period, and going well into probably the 60s, was in law enforcement training, you would fire double action unsighted and then single action for any sort of precision work. And this whole idea of you can't see your sights in combat really came from those eras. But if you look at like an original Smith & Wesson, what would be a duty police gun of the 1920s, guess what? You can't see the sights with a hammer down. The hammer actually covers the sights. That's where a lot of that came from. And that's why history is so important, to understand, you know, the equipment follows a lot of the training and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how much have we regurgitated you can't see your sights in a fight, which we know is not true. I can tell you that personally. But you tell people that long enough, well, that came from an era when you couldn't see your sights, or the sights were so poor on these guns you really couldn't anyways. But kind of going back, so what Fitz would do, you got to remember, he lived in New York. It's a cold weather type of place. The style and fashion of the day was for men to wear large overcoats. They would wear gloves, and not like, you know, little synthetic gloves that we have now of high-tech materials. They wore gloves to keep your hands warm, right, in extremely cold weather. And Fitz had big leather holsters sewn into the pockets of that overcoat, and would drop a pair of those snub cut-down 45 Colts into the pockets. And his draw stroke for engaging criminals on the street in an urban environment was he would literally lift the guns out of the pocket with his fingers, you know, with his trigger finger, because you got to remember, you know, these things got, you know, especially the old Colts had horrendously heavy triggers. So he's trying to, you know, he's lifting up, you know, with a 14-pound or, you know, 12 at least and better pound trigger. You could easily lift the gun out of the pocket without it discharging.
Right.
And would literally lift the gun out of the pocket with gloves on and be able to engage an opponent as soon as the muzzle cleared the pocket. Or if they had to, even in the pocket. But I think that was more, that wasn't done as much as everybody likes to think. But he could easily remove the guns and fire as soon as they cleared the garment. Extremely fast. It is something I use today with snub revolvers and regular pockets. But you know, winter clothing is tough. You know, and all the guys who are sitting here going, that's unsafe, that's not this, that's not that. go ahead and clear a heavy overcoat with gloves and get to your, you know, appendix carried red dot lighted sighted thing you've got in a Kydex holster, AIWB, and see how fast you get to it, because I guarantee you Fitz would smoke you into the ground.
Well, and let's hold that thought, because we got to go to break. And that's an interesting, there's a couple of interesting things going on there. But hold that thought. Right now we're talking with Daryl Bulkey. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by LuckyGunner.com and Federal Premium Ammunition. They paid for this, so you don't have to. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories, as well as the new EDC X9L, the 5-inch version, which offers discriminating shooters 1911 match-grade accuracy, superior ergonomics, and concealability. With modern service pistol capacity, they've got 15 and 18-round flavors, as well as reliability, at www.wilsoncombat.com. So we're talking with Daryl Bulkey, and we're talking about the Fitz Special, and you were discussing how what a lot of people have lost in looking at these guns, which if you look at them with today's maybe modalities or practices, it firmly in your mindset, you look at them, you go, wow, this doesn't fit into anything that's taught these days. This is, you know, patently unsafe and whatever. But if you look back at the context, and especially the mode of dress and the environment that he was in, it starts to make a little more sense. And I'm sorry to have interrupted you, but you were talking about especially heavy with winter clothing for the day, which a lot of people you know, don't understand, a lot bulkier than what we probably use, you know, now, with like everyone's used to like Arc'teryx and synthetic materials and stuff like that. That's not what they had then.
No, and even, you know, the way men dressed up until recently, just in a day-to-day regular operating environment, you know, men wore suits.
Mm-hmm.
Men wore tucked-in shirts into slacks with ties, and that was casual. You know, that's how just men dressed. And, you know, the mode of dress was different up until, you know, within the last, you know, 30, 40 years.
Right.
That was very common. I mean, if people think about what your grandpa wore, you know, it was, unless they were working in a rural environment, it wasn't jeans and a, you know, t-shirt. They wore, you know, what we almost consider business casual today.
Well, and the other thing too is like, what my grandpa wore, these guys might have considered him a hippie, you know, in comparison to what they were doing. So, depending on what generation you are and all that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's sort of, yeah, in your case, it might be, you know, some of a, you know, great-grandpa, you know.
Right.
But the, you know, the clothing differences, the material differences, the style of dress, the mode of deployment, the type of weapon, you know, they didn't have stuff like air weights, you know. So, you know, and Fitz also came up with a Detective Special, which is scaling down that D-frame that was a sort of an issue police revolver. You know, and, you know, kind of real lightweight calibers. You know, I remember the cops back then didn't really carry openly. You know, a lot of times they were, you know, if you look at old pictures of New York PD and even Los Angeles, other places, they carried underneath coats.
Yeah.
But they were generally 4 and 5 inch revolvers, you know, now, you know, and so that's kind of came up with the first snub, really, that was the Detective Special. And, you know, that sort of progressed. You know, Smith & Wesson started doing some pre-war 2-inch K-frames. They're very rare. I got one coming.
Of course you do.
And then, of course I do. And then immediately after World War II, when they went back into production, one of the first commercial guns Smith did was the 2-inch, what we consider the 2-inch M&P now, or the 2-inch Model 10, which is sort of almost the quintessential, along with the Detective Special, those were the quintessential detective and undercover and off-duty concealed carry guns for, you know, like the next, you know, 40 years.
Right.
And so, you know, this is where all that stuff came from. And, you know, and then you started getting into the Model 12s, you're using aluminum and the Colt Cobras and Agents, and again, using aluminum for frames to make them easier to carry. So it's all sort of a progression. It all kind of comes from somewhere. And, you know, guys get lost on where that somewhere is. Now, some of these guys, down in the Southwest, being based out of Texas now, and, you know, the fitting of guns down there was very popular.
Right.
And that wasn't for gloves. That was to get on a trigger faster. My business partner, Wayne Dobbs, and I were just talking about this. Wayne and I, when we went to the police academy, we were taught to put a finger on the trigger as soon as you drew.
Right.
I mean, nobody was teaching finger off the trigger. And the reality was, you know, in all honesty, we didn't have a lot of negligent discharges in double action revolvers that, you know, us thinking back to was very, very rare, with the exception is if the guns were cocked.
Right.
All the bad stuff happened is when guys cocked the guns. And that's why a lot of agencies went to neutering them and basically removing the single action capability, because almost every bad negligent discharge got traced back to that. What we kind of didn't realize until Roger Anoka's work starting into the 80s, was that there's ways to make guns go off without the brain being involved.
Mm-hmm.
Imbalance, falling, startle reflexes, things like that. And even those were a little tough to get through a 12-pound trigger pull. But that's where, you know, the finger off the trigger thing really anchored. I'll be honest, because I was there when it happened. Rule with keeping your finger off the trigger from the, you know, gun sight rules that we pretty much live by is really didn't get anchored until Glocks, if you want to know the truth, because, you know, police departments, when they started transitioning, went through, horrendous numbers of negligent discharges, which now there was a real penalty to having your finger on the trigger. Where the revolvers, it really, you know, they were preaching the rule, but it really wasn't applying real well. And again, not saying that they can't happen, but it is certainly not as likely with that long rolling, you know, action with the finger where you're turning a cylinder, you're cocking the hammer, and you're doing all of that with the trigger finger. There's a lot going on there, moving and releasing the striker, you know, which all of a sudden there's not a lot going on there.
Right.
It changes things. You know, it just changes the dynamics of all of a sudden, keep your finger off the trigger is a pretty, you know, that becomes a non-negotiable rule, where before that with the revolvers, it was quite negotiable. So.
Well, and that's, there's two things I want to hit on, and one of them will be brief. Then the other one I'd like you to expand a little bit, because you said a name that I don't think many people are going to have ever heard it before. The first thing, and you mentioned trigger weight, but I know you've written in the past some really excellent, articles, forum posts, whatever, but it's not necessarily weight so much as the distance it has to travel. is one thing I'd like you to talk about. But the other thing too, talk about Roger Anoka, and you mentioned his work. And I guarantee 80% of the people listening don't have any idea. So, and you can hit on whichever one you'd like to first.
Let me do Anoka. You know, one of these days you need to get Wayne Dobbs on the show to do Roger Anoka. Wayne Dobbs is like the biggest Roger Anoka fan on the planet. Wayne did a lot of studies with Roger, and because I teach with Wayne, a lot of it's a hand-me-down for me. I believe it was Colorado State or University of Colorado where he is out of. Again, you know, Wayne would have the in-depth knowledge on this, but, you know, he wrote a paper back, I believe it was early 80s, on a study of basically how, you know, handgun, you know, negligent discharges and how they occur from a physiology point of view, and came up with all of these things that will make a gun go bang without the brain being involved. And, you know, postural disturbance, which is, you know, falling, And they normally happen when you're falling backwards because people are reaching for the imaginary, stairwell handguard or something that they can grab. And when so the natural reaction is to grab, and then with handguns, they typically the round's going upward, and that's where all sorts of bad things happen. Again, startle reflexes, where, there's a noise or a surprise or something happens in which the hands will clench. Drawing a blank because I haven't had enough coffee yet, but basically it's an overage. So you grab something with your left hand, you're going to get a whole bunch of that.
Yeah, it's a sympathetic grasp.
Right. There's an actual another word for it that's even better. But and what will happen is, it's about 25%. Well, when you can grab, a adult male and you're grabbing 80 pounds with one hand and you're putting 20 into the other, all of a sudden,
guns go off.
Short of one HK, the VP-70, short of that one, they're all going off.
Right.
And so it's almost like you can't put enough trigger weight into them to overcome that overflow. That's the word I'm looking for. So, and if you look at particularly in police encounters where you're often grabbing people, we had a guy at my old agency, negligent discharged a SIG P-220 in double action, keying his radio mic at the end of a pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
Very high stress, high speed pursuit. He didn't know where he was. There was a wreck. There was all sorts of stuff going on. And he keyed that mic so hard trying to get help that he discharged his SIG. And, swear to this day, he didn't do it, But that's how that happened.
Hold, didn't do it. Right. Hold that thought, Daryl, because we got to go to break again. Silly ads. But we're talking with Daryl Bulkey right now. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by LuckyGunner.com and Federal Premium Ammunition. They paid for this, so you don't have to. This segment brought to you by BigTexOutdoors.com. BigTexOutdoors.com is the best place for you to find all your everyday carry needs at the absolute best prices. Maybe you need all the lumens from Surefire at the lowest price. No problem. Spend too much time alone in your room, and now you need an RMR in your pistol? Well, BigTexOutdoors.com has those. Glock accessories, yes. Fast, cheap shipping, 100% hassle-free returns, all that and more. And best of all, BigTexOutdoors.com has Ike. He's a good man and thorough. I like Ike, everybody likes Ike, and you'll like Ike too. Visit BigTexOutdoors.com today and find out what happens when every customer is a friend, not just an order. So you were talking about a dude at your agency that ND'd a SIG 220 after a pursuit trying to key his mic. And
right, and we've seen a lot of them, guys grabbing crooks,
yeah,
or fighting, and then they go off. And again, that's a full strength grab on one hand, and you get the fingers on the trigger, you get the other. And so on those things, on the stuff Anoka talks about, there's no trigger you can put in a gun that will really prevent that.
Right.
So that's where it becomes critical of keeping the finger off the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, so that didn't really start until the 80s. And, not everybody really got into the science of, except some of the gun dorks. but that's just now keeping up. So to try to apply something that nobody really even knew about, pre the 80s is, kind of a tough thing. But that sort of gets into what, we were talking about on my big thing, is where the revolvers, the DA autos, the LEM guns are, to me, really good for what I call people management, is trigger movement is very perceptible under stress.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something I picked up just as a cop on having multiple occasions of making a decision to shoot or actually being in a shooting. I haven't been in multiple shootings. The same thing applies, is I was never very much aware of trigger weight, but what I was always very aware of was trigger movement. And there's a lot going on with that you know your trigger finger's moving. Also, during those periods of stress, you start losing a little bit of your tactile feeling in your fingers and hands and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But where you pick that up is you pick up visual acuity goes through the roof. And the other thing I noted years ago, sort of thinking on these things, is that I could always see the hammer moving as well, periphery to the sights, which is basically you're seeing your trigger press. And, you know, I kind of noted that. And then, you know, I called Pat Rogers about it. I said, hey, Pat, I have this kind of theory I'm thinking about. And you're one of the guys out there who's pressed a lot of triggers on bad guys using guns with hammers. What do you think? And Pat starts thinking. He goes, you know what, DB, you're right. You know?
Yeah.
He goes, come to think about it, you're absolutely right. You know, looking back on that is you can see your trigger press. So that sort of became one of the things that I really like as a positive to DASA autos, LEM guns, and hammered revolvers is that you can see how smooth your trigger press. The other thing you see is that you are actually pressing the trigger.
Well, and that's,
you know, some people don't realize that they're pressing the trigger. It's all of a sudden you can see that. So taking out the situations that, you know, are startle, falling, you know, those type of things in which your brain's not involved in that process, that's a neurological, physiological reaction where that stuff's just getting fired through the nerves. With the stuff where there's thinking involved, those hammers and that amount of movement really help on managing crisis situations that you really want to do it. And that you're aware you're doing it versus, oh, shoot, it just happened.
Right.
And, you know, that's where all the bad stuff happens is when people are not focused on what they're doing in a crisis. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's their first time.
Yeah.
You know, I try to tell people, you know, you know that's a neat 3-pound trigger for shooting drills and doing cool shooting stuff, but you know, if you've never been in a massive crisis in your life, I'm going to tell you right now, trying to manage that 3-pound trigger and not having it go bang is going to be tough.
Well,
and you know, you have no fail safe there whatsoever of thinking.
Well, and that's kind of you know, I think that's where the high register really comes into play. I mean, and you know, so things progress. I think that's a better way to do things, period. But what you're saying is that having the extra margin for error can be the difference between, wow, that almost happened, and, oh, I didn't mean for that to happen. And at that point, stacking fail safes, if possible, not a horrible idea. And I know there are going to be some people listening to this that are going to be like, there's no way you can see hammer movement. One, I had a very similar conversation with Pat talking about revolvers at one point. And I was, you know, we were talking about it from a capacity standpoint. And then it came up ancillary to that. But the other example I have is, you know, Paul Sharp relayed a story to me where there was essentially what would have been a rescue shot that ended up not happening. But he says he was incredibly visually aware of his sight picture and also the movement on the hammer as he was trying to shoot this dude, essentially, and like multiple aborted trigger presses because the shot went away.
Right.
You know, all happening.
And you know what? That stuff, I'm going to tell you right now from having done a bunch of those, that stuff is so imprinted into your memory. I can remember a lot of those, actually all of them, right down to the details. I can, you know, the first shooting I was in, I can tell you right now exactly what the sight picture looked like on the bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, to the finest detail. So if you train yourself to look for them and always be doing that, you know, you'll find them in real life. But, you know, this kind of gets into, you know, why I like revolvers for a lot of people. You just mentioned one of my biggest issues and why I like revolvers for about 90% of the shooting public. And I'm going to make a bunch of people angry with that. But
that's okay.
If you get out of the 5,000 or so of us that are training all the time and going to classes and are, you know, kind of, you know, little gun training, you know, world. And you get out and watch the normal earth people moving around and carrying guns or dealing with guns. Watch people on a gun counter pick up guns at any gun shop, gun show, whatever. Where's the trigger finger go?
Right on the trigger.
Right on the trigger.
Yeah.
You know, watch them pick up guns on the range. You know, watch an FBI agent drop his gun on a, doing a backflip on a dance floor. Watch him pick his gun up, and where does his finger go?
Right on the trigger.
That. Right on the trigger, because people have been trained by television, and people have also not followed the four, you know, they don't take the four rules as seriously as we teach them. And they also do the, well, it's unloaded, so I can put my finger on the trigger, and that's all great until it's not. And then you have multiple violations, which then turn into either a discharge and nobody gets hurt, or a discharge and somebody gets hurt and killed, depending on how many of those violations occurred. But at two of them, they can start making loud noises. So one of the nice things about revolvers is when you do stupid things like pick them up with your finger on the trigger, they have a more of a tendency to not go off.
Right.
And again, for the newbie, novice, not working, not training, you know, the person who the greatest training they ever took was a license to carry or concealed carry class mandated by the state, that is not, in our world, remotely close. That is big-time training to a lot of the public.
Yeah.
And they think they're trained. I got a license to, you know, the license that says I can carry a gun. I'm perfectly trained. You're not even close.
Well,
and that's where these things are great. You know, I consider the nice thing about revolvers, they, you know, you can load them and put them in a sock drawer for 20 years and they'll be there when you need them. They're very good, what I call fire extinguisher guns.
Yeah.
For a lot of people. And, you know, somebody who went to a gun shop, bought a, you know, the newest whiz-bang semi-auto, they sold them, and they load it up and put it in the sock drawer for 20 years, is really going to have a problem when the time comes.
Well, and
you know, running that gun.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, and we got to go to break here in a second, so I'll say this thing, and we'll go to break, and you can respond. Everyone's like, well, they're harder to shoot, and, you know, people can't hit as much with them. And the thing that folks don't seem to understand is the people you're talking about don't shoot anyway. It is.
Right.
Yeah. And we'll pick back up on that when we get back. Right now you're talking.
Yeah, I can go right into that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Right now we're talking with Daryl Bulkey. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by LuckyGunner.com and Federal Premium Ammunition. They paid for this so you don't have to. So we're talking with Daryl Bulkey, and the thing we were saying before is, you know, people say things like, well, revolvers are harder to shoot well. And when we're talking about people that don't shoot anyway, giving them a gun that's easier to shoot can actually be problematic because it's easier to shoot, like literally easier to shoot, and pick up from there if you want to.
Yeah, and you've got Caleb Giddings did a great you know, kind of a U graph on like snub revolvers, and you know, it starts off with the top of the U on kind of experience versus you know, as their experience grows. So for a lot of people, for a very first gun they have, the nice thing with the revolvers is the administrative handling is super easy. I will tell you right now, most of the public out there that has semi-automatic pistols cannot do a loaded chamber verification, keyword, safely and properly.
Yep. 100% agree.
They can't even 100% of the time check to see if their gun is loaded and do that in a safe manner. To me, that's a massive problem. And again, that to me outweighs, well, it's easier for them to shoot. You know, if you can't tell the thing is loaded, having it easier to shoot is a double bad. And, you know, as people gain experience, and the other thing is, if you can learn to manage, if you can learn to shoot a double action revolver, you can shoot anything.
Yep.
So again, if we could train people initially to learn to manage a double action trigger, it will help them down the road as if we transition them into work in the semi-auto. So what will happen on that U is there's a great need for those revolvers in the beginning, and as they gain more experience, that decreases down to the bottom of the U. Well, once they get to the bottom of the U, where they're fairly well-trained and they're shooting and doing their thing, all of a sudden the need for that revolver starts coming back up, because then you get to people like me who use them all the time. I mean, it's hard. You'll be hard-pressed to catch somebody like me, Chuck Haggard, a lot of these other guys, without a snub in our pocket. And it's there for a reason. It's because I can put my hands in my pocket in any environment in a low profile, and I have a absolute 100% for real, no getting ready, no doing anything. I have a real, honest to God, sub-1 second draw with a J-frame in my hand in my pocket.
Right.
With no prep, no nothing. Every time it's, you know, coming in right at 0.95, about a second, I'll put one right in the head every single time at 3 yards. That is a real street encounter, and to me, that is a huge benefit. I don't have to clear clothing. I don't have to do a lot of stuff, and it's very low profile. So now as you gain all this expertise, the revolver starts coming back into, you know, doing a lot of stuff.
For a very specific thing, and that's the part
right.
that people miss.
Right, and so you have these differing needs on it. And then, you know, for when I'm driving around affordable housing neighborhoods and certain areas of metropolitan places, I like having a gun in my leg in the seat of the car. That's old police work stuff, working, you know, surveillances, crime suppression, stuff like that. We often rode around with a gun under our leg, and that is one place that you do not put a semi-automatic pistol.
Right.
You know, that is a 100% revolver deal. And so there's a place for a lot of these things. That, you know, and the other thing is, for me, when if I travel to somewhere that has draconian gun laws and magazine bans and all of that, I'm perfectly happy running a revolver and not worrying about it. You know, is it optimal? No. Would I rather have, you know, my HK Beretta, Glock, whatever, you know, my flavor of the week happens to be? Sure. You know, I'd much rather have a, you know, 15-plus capacity service pistol that I normally shoot. I'd much rather have that. But I don't feel horribly, you know, like killed in the street if I'm carrying a, you know, what I'm using a lot of now is, you know, a 7-shot, you know, 357 Magnum snub.
Well, and the other thing, too, and you mentioned this, and I think this is something that a lot of people, and I've had this happen, too, like, a lot of times people will look at something that someone is doing, and the person that is doing it has a very well thought out and very contextually appropriate reason for what they're doing. So like a revolver under a leg, for 99% of the people, that makes zero sense. They're not doing crime suppression. They're not doing surveillance stuff. Inside of that,
and they're probably not going to crappy neighborhoods on purpose,
right? And so, and like if they are going to crappy neighborhoods on purpose, they're not there to arrest people that might not want to
right.
be arrested. And
yeah.
and you know, I've had it happen too, to where I will do a thing, or someone sees me doing a thing, and they're like, "That's awesome! I'm going to do that too." And I'm like, "Whoa, that's you don't need to." Like, I've got a reason I'm doing this that does not apply to anything that's going on in the problem that you're trying to solve. And it sort of circles back around to the fits, which is kind of interesting. Is like, he had a good reason to do that. It made sense. And a lot of other people had a good reason to do that, too. Because if you're working in the gloves of the day, what a lot of people don't realize is you couldn't get a finger inside of some of those trigger guards, if the trigger guard was still there. Like, it just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, you look at, like, a USP.
Yeah.
Look at that trigger guard. It's designed for, you know, European NATO-allied people wearing winter gloves.
Yeah.
And then you go look at a detective special and see if you're going to get a big gloved finger in there.
One, especially when, you know, people were smaller then, too, and hands were smaller then. You know, well, not everyone's, but a lot of people.
No,
like,
well, see, and that was the thing. Vince was a big dude.
Yeah.
You know, again, you get back to that. You know, Vince, and then you know, you just talk about guys like, you know, Bill Jordan. You know, hello.
Yeah.
Bill Jordan had massive, massive hands.
Well, and that's the funny thing too, is that a lot of people seem to just. So, especially, and I hate to paint with a broad brush, but my generation especially, my generation and the generations under mine don't have as much of an appreciation for historical context behind things as maybe they should have to understand why things happened the way that they did, you know?
To me, the graduation in this business from being a student to a teacher and from being a person who shoots to truly understanding this stuff, you have to study the history. It has been a passion of mine. As I'm from sort of the first of the Y generation,
mm-hmm.
you know. I showed up at my police department in the late 80s as the first guy they recruited off a college campus. And I was always in trouble for asking why, you know, because, you know, you come out of a college environment, an educational environment, you want to know, well, why are we doing that? Mm-hmm. Well, that's because the way we've always done it. Well, that's not a good answer.
Right.
So then when you start tracking this stuff down, you start finding, and I'll tell you what, you know, none of this stuff is particularly new. And that's what drives me nuts, you know, as I sit there and I go, you know, and I'll give you a good example, AIWB. You know, it's the hot thing.
Yeah, it's not new. Not even a little.
It's not remotely new. I mean, I got pictures of pirates with their flintlock in AIWB, you know.
Right.
But it was a particularly very snub revolver-centric thing that cops did forever. Now, doing certain holsters, carry methods, draw strokes. We've developed off of it, but it ain't new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole thing with, at our training thing, you know, Wayne and I use, you know, B8 Repair Center bullseyes on silhouettes. We got that from Larry Vickers. I have pictures from the 1920s of Charles Askins with the Border Patrol training his guys with, guess what?
Yeah.
Silhouette targets with B8 Repair Centers on them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, that's 1920s. We didn't invent any of this.
No, it all just comes back around. And people don't understand that. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Daryl, but we're already towards the end of the show, man. That was super quick. Let me do this just real fast, and then we got to go. If people want to train with you or train with Wayne, where can they find you guys at?
Yeah, we still don't have a web person, so don't go to our website. But Hardwired Tactical Shooting on Facebook, just follow us there. That's where we announce all of our classes and have the links and all that. We're improving that. So,
yeah.
The Training Hub, another good operation that we have our stuff listed through. So
yeah, Firearms Training Hub.
The best bet with us is the Facebook page, and it doesn't get updated all the time, but everything we do class-wise and stuff is on there.
Right.
You know, we sold out. We do an annual revolver shoot, the Pat Rogers Memorial Revolver Roundup. It sold out in like 27 hours this year, but stay on top of that. If you really want some solid revolver training, we bring in guys basically who actually carried them for real.
Yeah.
And we're out doing, you know, real stuff in the worst violent times of our recent history. And you'll really know how to run the things for real. So
that is high on my list of classes that I want to make. And I was very sad that it sold out in 27 hours because I had said to myself, I don't have the money today, but I'll get paid next week. And then it's like, crap.
Boom. Yeah, we were surprised.
I wouldn't
and
be.
Then with me, if for people who are interested in the history of some of this, I run a page on Facebook called DB's Shooting Adventures. And I post a ton of historical, particularly revolvers, but there's a lot of history behind how these things were developed and super unique guns. And it kind of tracks what my wife and I are doing. You know, my wife's the instructor at Shoot Like a Girl. So we basically travel around doing all sorts of cool gun stuff. But the gun of the day thing I do, and then armed lifestyles for the normal earth people, those type of articles are on there, and it's no cost. You just get on there and read it, and it's become quite popular. So
yeah,
much to my surprise, and social media with my real name.
Well, no, man, it's great stuff. I follow it closely, and you know, thanks again, man. I really do appreciate you taking the time to come on and sort of talk about these things. It really means a lot to me that that you know, you give the listeners and me your time that way. So
I appreciate somebody caring.
I mean, that's
oftentimes I feel like an island in the tactical world.
Nah, man, I've come to the conclusion that the longer anyone does this, that seems to be a natural progression, just because of well, people are people. But hey, give my best. Give my best to your wife, and also I know you're hanging out with Cam and Michael this weekend, so say hey to them too.
I miss Michael, but I already went gun shopping and with Cam, so we're all set.
Perfect. Well, hey, man. I got to go now, but you be safe, dude. I will talk to you soon. Thanks again.
No problem. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, no worries. Hey, make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes. It really helps us out. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next week. Don't